Acts chapter 18, and then the passage that we're going to look at is going to be just sort of the beginning of the chapter again. We did touch on it last week, but I want to go a little bit further into it, explain a little bit more, share a bit more. Acts chapter 18, we're just going to take a look here at verses 1 through 6. 1 through 6, so we'll read this together. I'm reading from the NIV, so you can follow along. In chapter 18, verse 1, the Bible says this. After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth. There he met a Jew named Aquila, a native of Pontus who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had ordered all the Jews to leave Rome. Paul went to see them, and because he was a tent maker, as they were, he stayed and worked with them. Every Sabbath he reasoned in the synagogue, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia, Paul devoted himself exclusively to preaching, testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. But when the Jews opposed Paul and became abusive, he shook out his clothes in protest, and he said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I am clear of my responsibility. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles," which just means the non-Jews. Paul has arrived in Corinth, and we highlighted last week three of the crushing things that Paul was feeling when he showed up in Corinth. One of them was that he was flat broke. He had no money left. Because remember, Paul and his incredible, exemplary, being a role model for us, was basically working and paying his own way to be a church planter and a preacher. He was not relying on any congregation for his service to the Lord. So he shows up in Corinth and he's flat broke. And as I mentioned, many of us college students, we know that perpetual lifestyle of being broke. And when I say broke, I mean like he wasn't sure when or where he was getting his next meal. Paul also, when he arrived in Corinth, was extremely lonely because he'd been in Athens for a number of weeks. And as he'd been there, all of his gospel partners, the people who had been sort of working in the ministry with him, had left him there to return to the other church that he'd already planted. So they were all gone for weeks on end. And he's in this completely godless, Jesus unknown city for weeks by himself. Even for a godly and a spiritual person, that's challenging. He was alone. And finally, the last thing that he probably was feeling when he dragged himself into Corinth was that this was one of the first cities that he'd spent any time in, and he had failed to plant a church. I don't know if you guys have noticed, but he is sort of like stringing together a pretty nice succession of victories. It was Philippi, Berea, all these places that he went to before, he was able to plant a church in each of these cities. And now leaving Athens, sure, a few people became Christians and believers, but as he trucked from Athens and then went southwest about 40 miles to Corinth, the whole time he may have been thinking, "I totally failed in that city. Yeah, I was able to preach and proclaim, but what a shame that no ecclesia," in other words, no gathered community of real believers, actually was able to form there. He was feeling discouragement, which we all relate to. And I spent most of the time last week trying to explain how Jesus Christ, the person, was able and is able to fulfill and meet and exceed all of those things that we experience in our Christian life. You don't have to be Paul the church planner to feel spiritual bankruptcy or real bankruptcy, to feel loneliness and to feel discouragement and failure in your life. It's very common. And Jesus meets all those needs in different ways. What I wanted to look at this morning is I wanted to take a look at the three P's that I think stand out for us in this section. And the first one, the first P is provision. Provision. And the main thing that I want to get across is that when God calls you to a work, when God calls you to a specific work, a specific type of service, and it's his calling, he is going to provision you. He's going to provision you. In other words, he's going to provide the resources that you need. May not be what you want, but he's going to provide what you need. Why? Because a good God, and the God that we know from the scriptures, is not going to call you and send you to a specific kind of service or ministry and then leave you without the spiritual or physical resources that you need to do it. And so if you're a Christian and you're banging your head against a wall in a specific kind of service that you think you're called to do in the Lord, and yet you're finding that you're not getting the provision that you need to check your calling. Sometimes we get so set on what we want to do, what we're passionate about, that we don't stop and look and ask, hey, is God actually helping provide a way here? Or is this actually me trying to call and send myself? We had a person who was actually a part of the mission team when this church got planted years ago. And it was extremely difficult for her to maintain and keep a job and be here. And being a part of a mission team means that you're going to be a person who's going to be looked to be dependent upon and provide actually for other people. Not come on a mission and sort of need everyone else to help you out. Now, of course, we're all going to go through difficult situations and bumps. But time after time, she actually was not able to find good self-sustaining work up here in the Bellingham area. And after a while, it became clear that maybe God actually wasn't calling her to be up here in the first place. You have to ask those questions of yourself. It's not for someone else to tell you what to do. But I want to make it very clear that God will provide a way. He'll provision for you if you're being called to a specific kind of service. And we're going to get more of what that means for us a little bit later this morning. But I want to put that out there. Paul, it was providential that Paul got to do tent making. You see that he's a tent maker. He meets Priscilla and Aquila. They share the same occupation trade. Paul had been doing this trade since he was probably 12, 13, or 14 years old. All Jewish rabbis were required to learn and practice a trade with their hands. They did not get paid to teach the scriptures. It was not a paid position to do that in the Jewish system. So what did they do? All of the young men, they learned a trade. They knew how to supply for their own needs. So Paul finds himself broke. He arrives in Corinth. What does he do? Goes back to his skilled occupation and trade. Finds another couple to work with and starts working. What he basically was doing is working with leather. It says tent making, and I'm sure that some of the leather works that they did went to repair tents. But essentially what he and Priscilla and Aquila did is they worked with leather. They were leather experts. Now what happened, and you'll see God providing a great way for him, and you can't see it in the scriptures, but Corinth was the host of the second largest sports games in the known world. Of course, Athens had the biggest games. And so when Corinth would have these huge sporting events, people would travel from all over the Mediterranean and they would come to Corinth. Whether they were cheering for a particular sportsman or they were related to them or whatever else, or they were just coming for the entertainment. And what would happen is there'd be this huge influx of people coming to Corinth on a seasonal basis for these games. And guess what people showing up in town need? Housing. And there's already a shortage of housing in an old world like that. And so Paul, Priscilla, and Aquila found themselves with an abundance of leather and tent work to supply the needs that they had. So what I'm saying is God provisions what he will call you to do. And you see it perfectly happening with Paul. The timing was perfect. That was God. The second P, first one is provision. The second P is partnerships. Partnerships. And you see two different partnerships going on here. The first one is you see Paul meets Priscilla and Aquila for the first time in this passage. If you haven't been around the book of Acts very much, what you're hitting or stumbling upon is the beginning and the introduction of one of the most fruitful ministry, God-pleasing partnerships that ever existed in the history of Christianity. You're looking at the introduction of one of those right there. This is not like, oh, we have the same job, and so we kind of get along. You're looking at the beginning of one of the most pleasing, fruitful, powerful, God-honoring, and humble partnerships that you will ever see in the history of Christianity. And it's starting right here. Do you notice when God provides it? Probably when Paul was at his loneliest and most desperate point. God is good, but he will test you. But he won't let you fall. He'll give you what you need, maybe not necessarily what you want. And he provides this partnership. If you look also there in the beginning, there in verse 5, you notice that God allows other reinforcements to come to Corinth. What does it say there? when Silas and Timothy came from Macedonia. So these are the partners that he knew. He was working with them before. So basically, when he gets to Corinth, he's desperate. He's sad, he's lonely, and he's broke. And God says, I'm going to reconnect you and introduce you to some of the most influential, helpful, God-fulfilling, and promising relationships that you will ever know for the rest of your journey as a disciple on this earth. Because he knew and was intimate with Priscilla and Aquila until the day he died, and they outlived him. He wrote them letters from jail. He wrote them letters and mentioned them in scriptures that we're going to look at because he loved them so dearly. There is no friendship on the planet that can know, understand, or expect, or see, or realize the fulfillment that comes from doing God's work together. You can have close friends and close family ties, but when you add the spiritual element of doing the Lord's work together, you add a layer and a richness to a relationship that people that don't know about God can never understand. It is incredible. And Paul's about to embark on it with Priscilla and Aquila. And I'm sure Priscilla and Aquila had no idea what was going to be coming down their way by befriending a volatile lightning rod like Paul, right? Look in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 for a minute. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. You can keep your mark in Acts 18 because we will come back. I want to look at these partnerships because I want us to see in the Bible, I want us to see a lot of the different roles that people play when they do the work of the Lord. It's kind of a phrase that's sort of misunderstood and gets thrown around. 1 Corinthians 3, Paul is writing in this letter to Corinth, and this is 5 years later, but he says there in verse 10 and 11, read along with me. He says in chapter 3 of 1 Corinthians, starting in verse 10, by the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and someone else is building on it. But each one of you should be careful how he builds. For no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. And if you skip back a little bit to verse 6, you see him describe it with a different metaphor. He says, I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God made it grow. So neither he who plants nor he who waters is anything, but only God who makes it grow. The man who plants and the man who waters have one purpose. Each will be rewarded, etc., etc. God is using two metaphors. He's saying planting churches and building people together into the body of Christ is like planting a field. It's like cultivating the soil and working with farming land. And he also says it's a lot like construction, like building a house or a building. Well, the big question here is, we know Paul is sort of saying here he's kind of an expert builder. But what about people like Priscilla and Aquila? If I was to go and try and build a house on a raw site, what has to happen before you could actually pour a foundation? A lot. You don't just show up at a property and say, okay, we want to build a house, so let's just roll the concrete truck in, open up the hatch, and start letting it fly. A lot of work has to go into getting a site prepared for a house to be built. You got to pull all the debris and rubble out. You got to get the ground level. You got to gather up all the building supplies and get things ready. Then when other workers come to actually put the foundation in its place, it can be done properly. You got to get footers in, or your foundation is just going to flow all over the place. Won't be steady. You got to make it level. What about with farming and farmland? You want to grow crops in a field. Till the soil. Pull out the weeds. Get the stumps out. Get foreign things out of there so they don't take over the plants when you're ready to plant. You got to break the ground up. What am I getting at? Church planting has a lot of different roles that are needed to make it happen. It's not just Paul, the eclectic, uber-gifted church planter guy. And I hope this comes across. For churches to be planted, what you're looking at is you're looking at Priscilla and Aquila as site preparers and land cultivators. because Corinth is a city that gets planted. And yet Paul does not do it alone. He does it in partnership with Priscilla and Aquila, and he does it right out of their house. You catch that? He plants the church with Priscilla and Aquila, and he does so out of their home. They're fellow workers. They're site preparers. That's a role that often gets overlooked in common church sort of culture today. People are kind of familiar with the Pauls, Christian superstar people and church planters and things like that. But what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to plant a seed in each one of you to call and bring out the fact that there are probably many, many more Priscilla and Aquilas in this fellowship than we're actually aware of. But the problem is they haven't actually been given the proper time, space, opportunity, and training to be so. And I hope that can change in 2016. We have been tremendously blessed to have some of Priscilla and Aquila's already serving in great ways. We're tremendously blessed with couples like this. And the church does not function, the church does not develop without them. Churches don't get planted without them. The apostles and their work is important. But you notice God has a sort of plan and pattern that he uses to put these churches and give them life. And he does so, and he decides to do it with people like Priscilla and Aquila. Site preparation. Take a look in 1 Corinthians 16 for a minute. When you start looking at these real people from history that are part of the story of Acts, it becomes more and more real. It moves from sort of, oh, that was a nice historic thing, to something that, wow, that's incredibly applicable for us today. And you can look at it, you can see it with Paul and his writing. Look there in chapter 16, verses 15 and 16. You get another snapshot, a glimpse into what was going on. He writes there at the end of this letter, he says, "You know that the household of Stephanas were the first converts in Achaia, and they have devoted themselves to the service of the saints. I urge you, brothers, to submit to such as these and to everyone who joins in the work and labors at it. I was glad when Stephanas, Fortunatus, and Achaeus arrived, because they've supplied what was lacking from you, for they refreshed my spirit and yours also. Such men deserve recognition." Now look at verse 19. "The churches in the province of Asia send you greetings. Aquila and Priscilla greet you warmly in the Lord, and so does the church that meets at their house. All the brothers here send you greetings. Greet one another with a holy kiss." What's Paul talking about? He's saying the churches are getting planted not by charismatic leaders. They're actually being established by people who what? Devote themselves, verse 15, to the service of the saints. That is how the churches are getting established in the book of Acts. Paul comes along and plants a seed. He preaches the word of Christ and people come to belief. But for the things to really take root, it's not Paul. God is making things grow, but the way he's doing it is he's using households and he's using people who are devoted to the service of one another. It doesn't even say they were incredibly evangelistic and they went and shared their faith every day with 100 people. It says they were devoted to loving the saints. That means their brothers and sisters in their house or household or community group or house church, whatever you want to call it. And what did it do? It caused people to be incredibly attracted to it because the love of Christ actually was being expressed. It had life. Things were happening. And Paul says, "I want you to submit to people like this," not because they're ordained leaders. He says, "I want you to submit to people like this because of their love for one another." And he says, not only submit, but join them. Take part. Take up the work yourself. And then he refers back to Aquila and Priscilla in verse 19, and he says, you know, greet them warmly. And so the house church that meets at their place. I hope you're starting to see a little bit more about what the Bible outlines as what church planting looks like. It involved an apostolic team like the Timothys, the Silases, and the Pauls. Sometimes they were together and sometimes they weren't. But what they did was always temporary. They never stayed in these cities, and I've mentioned that many times. Even Priscilla and Aquila were traveling itinerant helpers. In other words, Paul writes again at the end of Romans, and when you read the end of Romans, you'll see that he writes to Priscilla and Aquila again, but now he's writing to them. They're in Rome. They're not even in Corinth anymore. But what have they done? The church is meeting in their house in Rome. They're devoted to the service of the saints. They have a partnership with Paul, but above all, they love Jesus Christ. They're two ordinary, hardworking, devoted saints of Christ. They're not preacher teachers. They're not doing big events. They're devoted saints. And the fruit of their work is astounding. They become one of those core couples that helps all of those seedling infantile churches take root, develop, and grow and become strong. You know, you think about Jesus' prayer in John 17. You don't need to turn there, but he says, I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one. It's like Jesus, before Paul was even preaching and had been converted, and before Priscilla and Aquila even came to believe in Jesus, he's already praying about the people who would come to believe in their message. Whose message? People like Priscilla and Aquila. People like Paul. Why does Jesus tell his first disciples to pray to the Lord of the harvest for workers? Why doesn't he pray for lost souls? God, I pray that you would save all the lost souls. He doesn't do that. He tells the disciples, pray for workers. And don't pray for workers that you could grab and then add to your denomination. He says, pray for workers so that they will be sent out. Why does he say that? Because he says to them right after that, because the Father sent me. It's not about hoarding and bringing in. It's about asking God to bring workers so they can go out. And this is what Priscilla and Aquila did so sacrificially. A mobile lifestyle like Paul. But they're ordinary people with stellar hearts, devoted hearts. In all of this work, whether you're, you know, apostolic church planner, teacher, preacher, whatever else, or you are a Priscilla and Aquila at heart, a servant, devoted to your brothers and sisters in Christ, all of these things are working together to plant churches, and that's the last P. We talked about God will provision you. He will provide a way if you're called to do it. The second thing was that there are partnerships that the Bible talks about that are powerful and they're irreplaceable, and we should not do church any other way except for the way that they're discussed and talked about. And I hope you're inspired by what you see, that it's not a matter of talent, it's a matter of devotion to the Lord. And the last thing is planting. Church planting. Now, I mentioned Paul probably felt pretty desperate and felt like a failure when he left Athens, because really a few people became Christians, but no real community was established. They kind of went back to their homes with some form of belief, and that was probably it. And we don't know how long it took for a true church to be established in Athens later. We don't know. But even when I say church planting, what comes to your mind? When I say church planting, what comes to your mind? Is it basically putting this together? Is that what a church plant is? Is that the goal? Like, if our church plant is successful, then we've put together a wonderful Sunday morning service. Is that what it means, that the church has been established? We don't really see that in the New Testament. I think there's kind of two views about church planting, and I think both of them are pretty extreme and really not very Bible-centered. Let me tell you about the first one. The first church planting view, I think, is a bit skewed. I call it the Lego building kit. The Lego building kit. I love building Legos with my son. And I'm a perfectionist, and so I love it that there is one correct way to at least build the pictured unit. I love that. You either get it right or it's not right. Now, I don't mind being creative, you know, and doing other things with the vlogs, but that drives me a little bit crazy. But I love spending the time with him doing that. And unfortunately, when we think about church planning, depending on what tradition you come from and what your background is, you know, we all might be coming from different streams of thought. But what I'm saying is that a lot of people, they think that church planting is like Lego kit building. Basically, if you have all of the right pieces, there's a formula for all of the right pieces for the church build. And if you have the right pattern or formula, i.e. the Lego directions, and you follow the formula with all the pieces that you think are needed with the right formula, then out pops a wonderful church plant, happily established in the Lord. Unfortunately, there's a lot of problems with that. A, when we start or plant churches, we never feel like we have the right pieces. I don't. I never have. I don't know for your guys' experiences. But you always feel like, I need that one foundational brick. And I'm not talking about Jesus. We got him. But there's always the role or the leader or the helper, the host. There's always pieces missing from our formula that we think about for patternistic planting. We also, what's attached with this is we think there's one blueprint. And if we can just get that blueprint right, in other words, if we can find all the verses in the Bible that talk anything about church planting, and if we take them and we harvest them, we collect them all together, we put them into one amazing set of doctrines or one amazing set of strategic plans, then even if we get other things wrong, if we get all of these proof texts right, and execute it, out pops a church, a living, breathing bride of Christ. And the sad part is whether it's this tradition or another tradition, churches have been planted with very biblical patterns, and sadly enough, they do not have the life of Christ in them. And it's tremendously sad. And the members and the thinkers and the strategizers and the church planners are all like, but we did everything you said, Jesus. We followed all the scriptures to the T, the best way that we know it. Why don't you bless what we're doing? Oh, boy. You see, you can do everything right. You can follow all the scriptures and you can make it a formula. And yet the life of Christ is not even in that congregation whatsoever. And it is tragic, and we should not be fooled. We are just as prone to this as anyone, if not more so. Don't be fooled into thinking about the Lego building church kit. It does not exist. Paul's going to find that out supremely well as the church in Corinth begins to add lots of believers, because it will become his greatest love, and it will also become the largest thorn in his side besides the Jews themselves. It will be an absolute love-grudge relationship. But it will be having the life of Christ in it. The second type of church planning I think sometimes we might think about, and you military guys will like this, I call it the D-Day. The D-Day church plan. And the D-Day church plan is characterized by these things. It takes a long time to mechanize the war machine, to get ready to launch that attack into this non-Christian area, whatever you want to call it. So the church will take a year or 2 years to develop up a massive mission fund. Huge amounts of money put together by very generous people, not to take a thing away from that. And we need to have all of the correct leaders and people in place. Basically, we're going to assemble all of the major resources that we need into one place, and then at the right time, we're going to send them out. Paid ministries. They'll have an updated projector like we don't. They'll have this. They'll have that. Basically, they're going to have everything that man can provide that's needed to make a church plant successful. We're going to provide it. Because we want people to succeed. We want the church to be established. We want it to grow. Good, sincere motives. Nothing wrong. But at the same time, too, there's a danger. that it's become about, do we have the right resources and the right things? I had a talk with my 5-year-old son. This was probably a few months ago. And it's the classic kids question. Hey, when you grow up, what do you want to be? And he said, I want to be a jet. I said, do you mean you want to be a jet pilot? No. I want to be the jet. Couldn't persuade him. Couldn't change his mind. On his poster for preschool, that's what he took in. I want to be the jet. Here's the thing. When we grow up as a church, what do we want to be? Do we want to be the things we've accumulated? The building, the updates, the equipment, the technology, the assets, the resources? Is that who or what we want to be? The people of God are the church, and we know this intellectually, but often we don't act like it. The church is the people. When the church grows up and matures, what do we want to be? What will it look like? For us, I want to bring this up because I want to deconstruct a little bit about some ways that we may have been around church planting. Not to point fingers and say these things are bad. So, a note here. There's a lot of things that we might say are unbiblical or unscriptural. And when I say that, I mean you don't really find them exactly talked about in the Bible. That doesn't mean they're always wrong. Be careful when someone says, oh, that's totally unbiblical. Well, there's a lot of things that are unbiblical, which means they're not in the Bible, but they're not wrong. There's a lot of things we do as a church that are not scriptural, but they're not wrong because the Bible doesn't speak about them. It's an open-ended issue. But the beautiful thing with the book of Acts, and I hope you're seeing it as we march through these chapters, are you seeing God's pattern for planting churches? It's not the Lego kit build, and it is not the D-Day invasion. God's pattern for building 90% of the churches that are mentioned in Acts don't look anything like this. And it's been very sobering for me. The churches that get planted in the book of Acts are weak, pathetic, small households of newbie Christians. That's how God planted churches in Acts. Now, we could look at that and say, wow, that's not very inspiring. Or at the same time, too, we might be even more realistic and say, oh, that sounds exactly like us. And in doing so, take heart in the fact and the work that God does, not what man manufactures. God will work however he wants with no resources, little resources, or lots of resources if we're not in the Spirit's way. One of the ways that we can get out of the Spirit's way is look to our scriptures and change our view of church planting if we need to. You know, I've been thinking about this a lot, and one of the reasons why is because God's Spirit has been alive in Oak Harbor.
Yes.
It's awesome. God's Spirit has been alive in Burlington and Mount Vernon. These places are not close to Bellingham. And I've been banging my head against a wall thinking, you know what? How long will it take for us to do a D-Day invasion for Oak Harbor? For the Bellingham Church, you know, we're a small group, for us to get this huge mission fund poured up, saved up, and then hire somebody and get this technology and get the facility rented and then do a big blast off and take over the island, even though it's really heavily armed because it's a military installation. All metaphors here, right? Metaphors. But how long would that take? It'll take forever. I don't think it's faithless. I'm just being pragmatic. But even if you don't want to look at it that way, what do they do in the Bible? Devoted to the saints' workers, Priscilla and Aquila's, which are there. They're already there. Site preparation has already been done. The ground has been tilled and prepared. The Spirit and the life of Christ is in that group. It's obvious. Yeah, they got issues. Every group has issues. But we as a church family, is it our vision, our thought, either let's do a D-Day invasion Or let's just hope they keep growing so that we can keep inviting them to drive an hour to come to Bellingham and worship with us to show their unity. I hope not. This is not a mothership operation here, and I hope we all understand that. This is about sending people out. It's not about making a mega church here. I'm not interested. Same thing with Burlington and Mount Vernon. You see, we could sort of say, oh, we don't really have any disciples in that particular community. Let's save up. Let's make a plan. Let's follow this formula. And then we're going to decide that that's where we want to go. And we're going to go make something get established and work there. Or we could look at the communities around us and see where God is already working, like Ferndale, and say, instead of doing that, why don't we just water where the Spirit of God is obviously already working? Instead of us saying, okay, let's come up with a strategy map, and that's the next big town, and that's where the university is, that's where this is, why don't we just follow where God is working already? Let's just open our spiritual eyes and look. It's a lot easier. It's His church anyway, right? It's not ours. But if we have a D-Day mentality, or we have the Lego kit building mentality, we're not going to be able to follow the Spirit. It doesn't mean that it's wrong, and it doesn't mean that it goes against the Scriptures. But what I'm saying is, as we've been going through Acts, I hope you are inspired by how little God uses to establish something amazing. That inspires me, and it gets me excited. And I'm excited about what's going on with this church. But it's not because of, look how many people we can try to get together on a Sunday morning in Bellingham at our building. I'm excited about the life of Christ that I'm seeing develop in surrounding communities, because it's nothing that we've done. We haven't been doing a thing with it. Yes, we have loving disciples that share their life and invite people in their homes. And yes, they're serving, but it's the Spirit of God moving. It's not our strategic plan. It's not a business. This is not an enterprise. This is the family of God. And when the Spirit moves like that, will you be with me? Will we be together and saying, let's water that? God makes it grow. We're not making a thing grow. But God says we can water. And that's tremendously exciting. Again, the question is when it comes to multiplying communities or multiplying and church planting, what's required? What's needed according to the Scriptures? You guys have seen the pattern. The only church that doesn't follow this pattern was Rome. Rome was the only church that was planted in the New Testament, where Paul sort of wrote letters and asked disciples from a lot of different cities to transplant themselves to Rome and start the church. But the funny thing is he sent them all there, and he didn't even show up until a lot later. They still didn't even need him. And the church got off the ground just fine. Why? Because people like Priscilla and Aquila were devoted to the saints. Highly sacrificial people. I hope that you catch vision from the Scriptures, not from me or a person, but that you can see the Spirit and the life of Christ taking hold in different pockets of where we live. And that you'll be moved and inspired by what you can see God do through everyone. Yes, we all have different gifts, and the gifts can be exercised in different ways, and we have different functions and different roles. But at the same time, too, it's incredibly devoted people, not charismatic people, not Uber leaders, that were causing these things to take off and take root. And for me, this is incredibly inspiring. You see, if you can learn in your community group or house church, cell group, small group, whatever you want to call it, if you can start looking at your local group as a church rather than as a group, part of the big ship, the better you're going to be. The more you're thinking about, we're going to replicate what we're doing right here, and I don't need someone else's permission to do it. Because I know the culture here is that where the Spirit adds, water is going to start pouring in. And when water pours in, hopefully God will build it up even more. But it's not going to be permission-based. It's going to be these individual communities, these individual house churches are learning to be a family, to be real with one another in their meetings. And then as they do that, they're replicating, not because they have to wait for some leader to take it along to the next thing, but because they already know how to function together. So when they go and split or multiply, you've got Christians that are in that group that already know how to live that life, that real life, where you're doing life together. You're not just showing up at scheduled meetings. But you already know how to do it because you've been doing it. It's never been about Sunday service. It's about the life that you've been sharing during the week. And so when the group gets added to and begins to multiply, the disciples are already equipped and ready to take part and watch it grow. You don't have to wait 10 years to raise up a Paul. Wait 5 years to raise up a Timothy to inspire us all and be the perfect Christian to show everybody how it's done. No, the disciples have the Spirit of Christ in them. They've practiced the shared life together, and now they're ready to share it with others and watch it grow. And it's beautiful. It's the way it was meant to be. It's what the Bible instructs us and shows us a clear pattern. When Jesus talked to Peter about the church, he said this: I will build my church. We can't say it enough to ourselves. Jesus is the head of the church. He's the authority and he's the source. So let's let him have his way. With me? It's not your kingdom come. It's not my kingdom come. It's his kingdom come. His will be done. Let's get out of the way. Let's look at church planning. Let's look at the roles in church planning, the way that the Bible talks about them, and be moved and know that God will use his Spirit to work through any and every man and woman to get his message across. Amen?
Amen. Amen.